back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
It is Extension 720, and I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we're going to go to Lincoln Square, talking to Mike Fouché about his neighborhood. We had a good conversation. Baker Miller, which was the bakery right there on Lincoln Avenue, which is near and dear to me because I knew it as a carpet store that I lived next to and above almost 25 years ago, which is crazy to think about. But I go back to my old haunt. Talk with Mike about the emerging and changing neighborhood of Lincoln Square. We'll also talk with Benny Felsen and Caitlin Deaver about their great movie Booksmart, which will be coming out in theaters, limited release this weekend, and then a big release, I think it's the next week, Memorial Day weekend. Whatever it is, it's a summer blockbuster. And it's getting great reviews, and we'll talk with the two stars of that movie coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, it's been too long since my next guest has been in studio. I'm pleased to welcome our resident philosopher to the new Extension 720, Al Genia, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. He's also an avid student of the philosophies of the world. Is that a good way to say it?
That's correct, Rita. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Lovely new studios, lovely new home.
I have a lot of questions for you. A lot of personal questions for
you
we're going to get to.
All right.
But I want to get into, it's safe to say that you have been spending your life in the pursuit of meaning.
I've been spending my life reading wise individuals. I've learned recently, to my great discontent, that I am well learned, but I'm not necessarily a great thinker. Mm. That is, I've learned a great deal. I've read a great deal, but I'm not a profound thinker. And yet I've tried to be a profound thinker my entire life and taught philosophy at one kind or another, at one level or another for the last 50
years. How did you learn that? What did you come to a conclusion at some point? You said, I'm just not that smart?
Do I have any conclusions? Yes. Socrates is right. I know less than I know. And as I'm getting older, I forget more than I thought I knew every day. But I do think that I think philosophy is not simply a system or a series of answers. It's a pursuit. Mm. And that's what's intriguing. It's a pursuit. It's the questions, not the answers always.
Yeah.
Heidegger said that. Heidegger's back in the news. And by the way, if you're interested in pursuing philosophy in any way right now and want to go at it another way, Hannah and Martin, which is playing at the Shattered Globe Theater right now, the relationship between Hannah Arendt and Martin Heidegger is fascinating. In its attempt to say, he's saying, listen, you can't always answer the big questions, but if you're to be a human, you have to ask the big questions.
Right. Well, the question you're always asked, and that's the premise of tonight's conversation, 312-981-7200 if you want to get in. But the question you're asked, as you study philosophy and you maybe you're not... What is it? You're not wise enough to think. You're not a thinker, but
I'm a good communicator. I'm a good communicator of philosophy.
People will ultimately say, Al, I love philosophy. I've read a lot of great books. What do you think is the most important one? What's your favorite philosophy?
And you're not the first person. You're probably the 10,000th person who has. Well, you know, you're the resident philosopher here, there, everywhere.
Yeah, right.
You've been around and you've got all these books. So what's the most important book you've ever read? What's the most interesting book you've ever read? You know, tell me. I just want that. And for years I looked at people and I said, I can't do this. It's not possible to answer this question. So I would give them a list, a laundry list of books. I said, well, you have to start, of course, with Aristotle. You could do that in English, not necessarily in Latin or the Arabic or the Greek from which it's translated. And then you have to work your way up to St. Thomas. And don't forget, you have to go back to Socrates and Plato. And then we get into the Enlightenment. And then there's the Devotio Moderna. And then John Rawls comes along. And then their eyes glaze over.
You're in a coffee shop? And they're like, I
got to go. And I thought, wisdom can't be taught and I can't communicate it. And then I realized that they're asking a very serious question that really can't be answered, but it can. I think, rather than saying the most important philosophy book ever written, my answer is, what's the most important philosophy book that I've ever read? And that's Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Ooh, here we go.
Meaning. And it's a fascinating book about Viktor Frankl, an Austrian, MD, and then a PhD in philosophy, who was rounded up by the Nazis in World War II, and he and his family and his young bride, who was pregnant with a child, and his parents and his sister were taken off to the various Auschwitz camps, and he spent over 3.5 years, and he lived through Auschwitz. And in this experience, he had to ask himself, he found out that the worst things in the world really can happen. Mm. That your worst imagination cannot comprehend and deal with the madness that he saw. That you cannot believe hundreds of thousands of people being exterminated every week, thousands of people every day, that the air is always a musky gray, and what it is ashes from the crematorium, et cetera, et cetera. He can't believe that I lived 4 or 3.5 years on less than 700 calories a day, a cup of gruel every day, and perhaps a potato or a little piece of bread. He can't believe that he had lost half of his body weight, yet did heavy manual labor day in and day out, often in the cold.
It's more than the human mind can
comprehend, and more than the body should be able to learn. He says one of the lessons he learned at the camp is that he found out, and he was a doctor, that all the medical community was wrong. The human body could cope with more torture, more pain, more cold, more sleep deprivation, and more starvation than any medical books have ever even suggested as the outside possibility. And through this all, he realized there were certain basic things here. He's being tormented by this. He's lost everything in these camps. And these camps brought out the worst in people and the worst that ever could happen to people. And yet, in that, he had to decide to live or die. Because it was easy to die. And he talks about some of the people who gave up. He called them Muslims. He didn't mean Muslims in that sense. He called them Muslims that they simply caved in. And that was a term that they created. They had no connection to an Arab tradition. And they stopped eating. They stopped standing up. They stopped shaving. They limped, and therefore they were selected and gone, or often would give their bread away the night before because they knew that they couldn't take it anymore.
They couldn't take it anymore, so they wanted to stand out to
They
wanted
to stand out to die. They wanted to say, because it was easier to die. Suicide was a huge problem in the camps. In fact, the guards would shoot you if you didn't try to stop a suicide, because they'd run into the electric wires, because that was a quicker way to die than perhaps other things. And he said, in all this, throughout this whole time, that what we had to do is, I found out that what we were looking for in all this, when everything was stripped away from us, when even as Jews or Christians, you had to ask, if there is a God, why would he permit this?
Right.
That what we were actually doing was trying to locate meaning. That being in these camps, that the basic philosophical question is, what is the meaning of my life, or what meaning can I find in life?
Al Genie is here, our resident philosopher, and he's also a business ethics professor at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. We're talking about the book Man's Search for Meaning. This is Viktor Frankl's book, which we'll get into how he came about with this book, but obviously as we hear the story you can understand why this may be, as you say, the most important book in
philosophy. Right, this is not Socrates sitting on the, on the veranda in
it's
front
about
of
Parthenon
and suggesting, well, let's debate issues.
Right.
This is a man under de-stress 24/7.
Al, let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll come back because I think, you know, at the beginning of the show, I talked about the difference between book smart and street smart.
Mm.
And this almost fits into the way that you do have Socrates sitting on a very book smart, talking, having the luxury to debate the higher meanings of our purpose, where you have Viktor Frankl, who doesn't have that luxury in the moment
and
on the street.
Must choose every second to stay alive.
Al Genie, my guest on Extension 720, 312-981-7200 if you want to get in. We'll take a break. Come back. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200. We are talking about philosophy with our resident philosopher, Professor Al Genie, who for years has been asked the question, what's the most important book in philosophy? And there are many people who will argue about what school of thought and what debate and what philosopher in whatever time was the most influential or the wisest.
Yeah.
But you call out a point in this when we're talking about Man's Search for Meaning, which is written by Viktor Frankl, which may not be a household name when it comes
to
philosophers.
He's not now, but he was for my generation.
Yeah. But millions and millions of copies.
14 million copies sold, in excess of 14 million copies sold. And in reality, he's translated in every language, and he lived to 92 years of age. In fact, I have a personal story. In 1969, I was a rookie professor at Loyola University, and Loyola University celebrated its 100th anniversary. And for that, we brought in scholars from all over the world, including Hannah Arendt, which I who I got drunk with and smoked cigarettes with, Foucault, Conrad Lorenz, and Viktor Frankl. And I was sent to the airport to pick him up. And I kept looking for this tall, kind of slump-shouldered Jewish fella coming off the plane looking haggard and tired. No such person gets off. So I go up to the white phone in those days, and Frankl, would you come to the white phone? And this short, 5'8", beautifully coiffed, first manicured fingernails I'd ever seen on a man, in a perfect suit with a young Fräulein, said, Frankl here, good to meet you. And I said, Professor Frankl, I read all your books, says, and I thought they were really wonderful. Yes, they are very good. Good. Let us go. I would like to go to a nightclub.
Now.
And it was 8:30 at night, and we went to Mr. Kelly's.
Oh, there you
and
go.
I stayed at Mr. Kelly's most of the evening, and I thought, this can't be Viktor Frankl. He danced. He was having a wonderful time. He was really drinking. And the next day, he got up and talked.
Yeah.
And the room was in tears. And somewhere along the line, he just pulled up his shirt. And there were there were a series of numbers, and I have them right here. 119-104. And he said, these I never forget, and these I'll never be able to overcome. But it was the worst in my life. But it's given me something to give to life. Mm. My meaning is to share the fact that the desperate pursuit of every human being in any condition is to find some meaning in life.
It really is a great question to debate, because when you think about the philosophers that are idolized in academia, you think of, like we mentioned, the Socrates or the Aristotle, but this concept of them in flowing robes, sitting on rocks, and having a conversation about
conversation,
life.
Right.
Please pass the grapes, right? That kind of thing.
Right.
But to recognize that to find meaning, you need to be in moments where that meaning is questioned, or that meaning is
lived,
pressed.
Lived. And I think that you make a wonderful distinction, even referring to this play. Heidegger became this genius, is now recognized still as a metaphysical genius, but he was so lost in the clouds, he didn't realize that Germany was being surrounded by Nazis, and he caved into the Nazis because he didn't want to stop thinking. And because he didn't want to stop thinking, he was co-opted by the Nazis and abused by the Nazis, so on and so forth, and almost lost his place in the university system because of it, and Hannah Arendt, his former student, helped to save him. But he was so lost and speculative thought, he wasn't sure of anything else in life. And I think philosophy should not be how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. By the way, the answer is 9, 11 if two of them are anorexic. But anyway, it should not be, what is the sound of water at night? It should not be, do things exist when I am not around them? That's speculative harmonics. I think they may be true at a certain level of logic, et cetera, to clarify thinking. But I think Socrates is right. The essential question of life is, how do I live well with others? How do I have dignity in life? Mm-hmm. How do I live this life without damaging others? And Socrates always says, I'm not interested in cosmology. I don't care about, ellipses. I don't care about nature. In some sense, he overdid that. But he says, I care about how do we as human beings interact and what are our obligations to others. So I think when philosophy loses itself in speculative harmonics, it deserves the criticisms it gets. But this is a man who blended both his degree in medicine and then psychiatry and then a PhD in philosophy and said, what is the purpose of life? And he wound up saying, the camps, these horrible experiences, where they lost everything, where the pain was excruciating, where there was constant death, where constant trials and error, forced people to make decisions about life. That, we often think of many of the Jewish inmates there, and I can't imagine it. I've studied it, the Holocaust, so much, it's numbing to me. But they had to make a decision to stay alive, so they weren't just robots after a while. They may have been robots getting on that train, not knowing what's going on, because they couldn't believe that other human beings would do this to them.
That seems to be a big through line, too, is just about belief or what the boundaries are of what you can fathom, what you can accept, what your brain can accept is the limit. And that seems to be almost at the crux when it talks about the philosophy of Frankl's talking about this concept of what we know versus what's reality.
Yeah. And I think he develops a psychiatric formula called logotherapy, and logo – in Greek means meaning, mind, or meaning, excuse me. And so he's trying to find the meaning therapy. What do we need in life? What directive force? Now, there's a danger in this because you could get the wrong meaning. We know that, you know, many of these white supremacists are fanatically driven to this. Some of these shooters in recent history, and by the way, 46, 45 school shootings since the beginning of the year, this awful thing. Some of these people doing it for random acts of violence, some doing it for psychotic reasons, some doing it because they believe that this is a good thing to do. They have meaning in that. They're, right. You know, and there's a danger in false meaning as well. And I think Frankl's talking about meaning that surrounds you with, in the Socratic question of meaning that gives you the ability to live well with others.
Well, that's the great point. Yeah. Live well with others that you're talking about, because you're right. It's hard to say that the horrific acts of someone who decides to do a mass shooting.
Yeah.
Isn't steeped in their own search for meaning or their own belief structure. They're doing the same thing. They may be just misguided.
But it's misdirected and it's malevolent in a very real sense. And so I think that what he's trying to blend here is the psychology of life, an ethics of life, and a respect for human dignity. And what he suggests, you know, is very clear. Besides, he said he learned four things in his camp. The first thing I pointed out to you was that the human body could take more suffering than he never thought possible. Secondly, even in the face of senseless, arbitrary cruelty, we have a nagging need to find meaning in our lives. To live is to suffer, whether you're suffering with a sick child, whether you're suffering from a disease, whether you're suffering from poverty, whether you're suffering from lack of love. Even in that, we seek to survive by finding some meaning in that suffering. I must tell you, I've had some physical illnesses lately, and my only comfort is, I'm serious about this. I wish it made me feel much, much better, but people are suffering more than I am. Okay. And there's comfort in that. You know, I think we get lost in the solipsism of self. And we forget we're not the only kid on the block, right? My grandmother used to say, you complain about not having new shoes, and there's a guy over there without feet.
Yeah.
Boom, right? And the third thing you talked about, that forces beyond our control could take away everything we possess except one thing, the ultimate human freedom to decide how we face our fate, to decide how we do it. And maybe the best example of this is the dignity with which both perhaps horrible people facing execution, formal execution, go to their death. The dignity with some of our great heroes, you know, I have we're used to be in a building where it said, I have but one life to give to my country, right? Right. You know, Patrick Henry. But to find meaning even in that madness is, and finally, and we could talk about this a little bit, and this is not a promo for my book, that humor sustained him. Little pieces of humor. That is, holy, some part of humanity has to laugh. And when you can't laugh, you dry up.
Professor Al Genie in studio tonight, our resident philosopher, talking about the search for meaning and man's search for meaning, Viktor Frankl's book about the most important piece of philosophy out there, as he's been asked that question several times by students and others in coffee shops, and then Al's answer is really, really long, and their latte gets cold. Professor Al Genie, my guest here in Extension 720, 312-981-7200. If you want to join the conversation, do so. We'll get to all that right after the news, so stay with us.
So, you're a philosopher?
Yes. 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 I think very deeply. I think very deeply. I think very deeply.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman, Al Genie, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. Also, our resident philosopher is here tonight. He's also the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Tonight, the theme is by the book.
Yeah.
You know, and I love that you're here to talk about this, and it kind of works out because it really, we're kind of parsing out this idea of the difference between book smart and street smart.
Right.
But this difference, and can you live?
And we can even make a distinction in the book. First of all, he wrote the book 9 days after he left camp.
And we're talking about Frankl's book.
Frankl's book's important.
Man's Search of
Meaning. Man's Search of Meaning. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, this is a gentleman who was 92 years old when he died in a different era. Man is the Latin concept of mankind. Mm. So it's not specific, gender specific, but of course it'd be how people should do it. Anyway, he wrote the actual, his experiences down in 9 days after he left camp, hung on to them a while, and it was published, I think, in 49, called The Existential Philosopher's Trials or something like that. I've forgotten the name right this second. And then later, in the 50s, it was picked up, and the second part of the book was his theory of logotherapy, which he developed out of his experience in the camp. So what I'm suggesting to you, ladies and gentlemen, don't read the second part. You'll get lost in the particulars of the philosophy and the psychology of it all. And if you're not a clinical therapist, it may not be worth your while. But the first part is his diary, his memoir, rather than a diary, his memoir of his experiences from the time he and his family were arrested and sent off on a train to the concentration camps. So in a very real sense, Frankl was two things. Frankl was a real theoretician and a practitioner.
And there's something about him being a messenger when it comes to the idea of a search for meaning.
Yeah.
That you trust the messenger because he was faced with life and
death. Right. He's not talking about, again, how many angels can dance on the head of the pin. I don't know, 6, 7. Who's going to beat me on that, right? But he could say, the reality is, Nietzsche is right. And by the way, Nietzsche was not a funny fellow. Nietzsche was kind of a strange philosopher. Nietzsche gets more creds in philosophical circles than I really think he deserves. But Nietzsche said something, one line is worth his entire memory. That which does not kill me makes me stronger. Mm. That which does not kill me, Frankl would translate to, that which does not kill me teaches me something to make me stronger.
And it is interesting because Frankl was able to really search for meaning and decipher the concept of life and death and bounce that off of old philosophies that he had studied and you know, whether it be Nietzsche, whether it be Socrates or whatever, and be able to, in the moment, have a say, hey, yes or no.
Yes, this works. This works. That doesn't work. This is a real guy. I had the experience of rereading Day of the Rose, the famous book, and there was a disputation going on. Did Aristotle allow laughter? And did Jesus really own his own clothes if he was divine? Oh, give me a break. They get lost in the minutiae. They got lost in the minutiae of the text rather than wondering what it was about. And I think for Frankl, he made it alive. He made it real by saying, I lived through this. I found meaning. I had to find meaning to continue. I wanted to live not for me. I wanted to live to see my wife again. He assumed his parents were dead because they were older in the selection process. Although his wife was pregnant, she wasn't showing. And he was hoping she was alive. She was not, as it turned out. But he clung to his image of his wife. He clung to this love of his life, of his wife. And he said, the salvation for me was knowing that I loved her and I held her as my beloved. And I wanted the chance to see her again. And one dreary winter day, the second year into the concentration camps, he was suffering from dysentery and everything else and didn't know if he was going to be selected that day because he looked wan and he looked weak. Mm. And he said to his friend Otto, and if I may quote him, listen, Otto, if I don't get back home to my wife, you should see her again, then tell her, I'm going to cry, tell her I talked of her daily. Secondly, that I loved her more than anything or anyone. Thirdly, the short time we have been married to each other has outweighed everything, even the horror that I have gone through.
The search for meaning in life only can happen, I mean, it can happen in different ways, but it seems in what you're saying, the search for meaning can happen when that life flashes before your eyes.
It sometimes does. I mean, the gallows wisdom is sometimes very acute but very short-lived, obviously. But I do think that I've seen people really unhappy who, and when I really push them, I mean, I've lived long enough to be with friends and known them for 30, 40 years, and one of the continuous issues is they're unhappy, and they're not. I don't mean, in America, we think of happiness as, you know, do I have enough money? Are my kids going to the right schools? Am I my career going well? They lacked a purpose. That their life was full but purposeless. And to me, I translate it as meaningless. All right, they did their job, they paid their bills, but there was nothing beyond that. And one of the real critiques, and Heidegger did talk about this, that because we forget that there is a larger issue, there are larger parameters, there are larger goals in life than just living, we get caught in the minutiae of living. And that's not meaning, that's busyness.
Yeah, right. We talked about that. That's been something we've talked about in this program. 312s and 773s both, they make a good point that, you know, 217 says, my uncle gave Frankl's book to me about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
A great read. It was a household name, 312 says, to anyone who went to college my time. Read it 40 years ago. I agree, and all that you're talking about. But I guess the question, and there may be, if you're in philosophy, if you are a philosophy student and you're pushing forward, you're going to know the name Frankl. But for a generation that may be...
A generation of non-readers or
just not focused on philosophy in that way, or the way that colleges used to be focused on it. They have no idea.
They have no idea. And I think it used to be taught in psychology courses. There are two books that I've taught over 50 years in which students have come to me, rather ask me, what's your favorite book? He says, I only remember two books in college, and you taught them. Abraham Maslow's Man's Search for Meaning, which we were talking about during the break, and maybe we'll do that next time. We'll think about that. Secondly, Viktor Frankl's book. Because they weren't just... they just weren't technical, logical doctrines that you had to parse and figure out. And what does this mean? Is this a double negative? And how does this work out? Rather, they were life-driven, and the very purpose of it was to find some purpose in your life that keeps you going. Why are you here? Why are we getting an education? One of my real laments, and I'm in the School of Business, but it's not that, and I'm not critiquing that, is that too often now people go to college for a job. And I think you go to university to get a job, that's all right. But there's got to be more to it than that.
Right.
Because I always say that a business person is a vocation. A business person should have value. A business person should have a goal. A business person should have ethics. It isn't just making money. And I think Frankl is saying that, that you have to find something in life larger than the pain, the normality, or the given pleasures. We have to find something larger that we could call purposeful.
And it really is about, as he in the book, and he talks about this, you get to this point where meaning is all you can take out of it.
Right.
That's a search.
That's all.
And maybe he's never going to get to the end of it, but it's that search. It's that want to figure out what's happening that pushes you forward.
Right. And I'll quote another philosopher. Jean-Paul Sartre said, and I thought at the time, the first time I read it, it was totally absurd, that even if they're tying you to the stake and gagging you and blindfolding you, you still have the freedom and the meaning left in your life to yell in the back of your brain, no to you. Well, that's kind of desperate meaning. But I think Frankl's talking about another kind of meaning. In the end, I think the meaning of an individual's life is to help other people find their meaning and to be meaningful with others. And Frankl is really talking about parochial meaning, not transcendental meaning. Although, of course, religion can be the meaning and directive force in one's life. But he says you have to translate religion. My grandmother used to always say, I love my grandmother. I miss my grandmother immensely. It was just Mother's Day. And, and this is all in English. She would say it in Italian. I hate the people who go to church all the time, go to communion, stick out their tongues. We're Catholic Italians, of course. Stick out their tongues, so on and so forth. Then during the week, they kill people. What was that religion about? You know? And Frankl's talking about religion should be a directive force in your life to others, not... You know, just one has to be in the Presbyterian Church because one is a business person after all.
Al, always good to see you, man. It's been too long, and you know, I hope you feel better.
I do feel better.
So, where are you at in your recovery? Here, you had back surgery.
I'm
where
in
are you
week
at?
Eight.
In week eight.
Yes, and I want to help the general audience. And I've had a number of back surgeries. I think I found the reason for it. It's called age. So, ladies and gentlemen, do yourself a favor. Do not get old, and you'll be fine. Hey, bad things happen even to good people. I just got a bad piece of luck here. I'm going to be fine. mind. But thank
I will
you for
say
asking.
This, and I hope that this means something to you from me and to, I think, the audience listening, is it is a joy to have you here. These are questions that I don't think get asked enough and answers that aren't searched for enough. And it is a pleasure, even though you are in misery, you, of course, bring the energy and the excitement for the show. And I can't thank you enough for coming down to the studio at night here. And then I think earlier you were telling me in the break, you're like, yeah, I saw someone on the L on the way in. I'm like, what are you taking the L? You ain't got a black car or something like that that you can...
Well, I was hoping you were going to send one, but apparently it's not in the budget.
Oh, jeez.
But thank you for being here.
I really appreciate
it's wonderful being here together. The radio audience has noticed this. We've actually been radio buddies for about 25 years, and I'm glad it's still going.
And there's a reason it's still going, because you continue to...
Because you're desperate and you have nothing else to do.
No, you continue to bring meaning and to push and to try to talk about things that aren't usually talked about. Al Genie, professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. He is also the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives, our resident philosopher. We'll see you later this summer. Thanks, Al.
Take care.